every month. That would be tomorrow, 1 o'clock in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids.
Good morning. Congress is stepping up oversight of the administration's attacks in the Caribbean after a report that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave an order to kill everyone on board a boat. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump has said Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should be pardoned for alleged corruption. Now, Netanyahu himself is asking for one. I'm Leila Faldin.
Enemy Martinez, why now after 2 years of war? Also, new documentary takes us inside the bedrooms of children killed in mass shootings, which their parents have left untouched since their deaths. It's Monday, December 1st. On this day in 1991, more than 90% of Ukrainian voters approved a declaration of independence from the Soviet Union. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is doubling down on his plan to block asylum claims from people living in countries on the U.S. travel ban list. This comes after last week's attack on two National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. One soldier died, the other remains in critical condition. The suspect is from Afghanistan, and now Trump has stopped all immigration requests from Afghan nationals. Speaking last night, he says he'd go a step further. Trump says he would like to strip naturalized Americans of their citizenship if he wants.
If I have the power to do it, I'm not sure that I do, but if I do, I would denaturalize, absolutely.
Separately, each group of National Guard troops patrolling in Washington, D.C. will now be joined by at least one city police officer. The House and Senate Armed Services Committee are opening inquiries into the Pentagon's deadly attacks on boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific. This comes after a Washington Post report a follow-up strike on survivors of an initial strike was done following Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's order to kill everyone on the boats. The Pentagon has denied this. New changes to SNAP food assistance programs could be coming this week. NPR's Jude Jaffe Block reports Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins promised an announcement the week after Thanksgiving.
SNAP, also known as food stamps, helps almost 42 million Americans get groceries, though enrollment is expected to dip because states are implementing new eligibility and work requirements that Republicans in Congress passed over the summer. Rollins says more changes to SNAP are needed. She alleges there are widespread problems with SNAP households receiving benefits fraudulently, but has not released detailed data, and many food policy experts say such cases have historically been rare. Rollins sparked a flurry of confusion last month when she said everyone in SNAP would have to reapply, since SNAP applicants already go through a recertification process, typically every year or 6 months. Jude Jaffe Block, NPR News.
Indiana lawmakers are expected to convene today to discuss new congressional maps. These maps are aimed at helping Republicans win two more seats in Congress. From member station WFYI, Ben Thorpe reports.
Republicans last week appeared to cave to months of pressure from President Donald Trump to draw maps that could eliminate the two Democratic congressional seats in Indiana. Senators initially rejected calls to vote on the issue, with Senate leadership saying he would not call lawmakers to the Capitol because there weren't enough votes. But following that decision, both Trump and Indiana Governor Mike Braun said they would support primary challenges against lawmakers who were not supportive of the new maps. Lawmakers also faced anonymous threats to their families, homes, and businesses that seemed connected to the ongoing debate. The Indiana House will gather this week to discuss new maps. Next week, the Indiana Senate will meet to vote on whatever proposals come from the House. For NPR News, I'm Ben Thorpe in Indianapolis.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Officials in Hong Kong have increased the death toll from last week's apartment fire. It's now 151 people. Authorities say that some of the netting surrounding the buildings that burned did not meet codes for fire resistance. Thousands of people are now homeless after the immense blaze burned for 2 days. The death toll from flooding and landslides in several Southeast Asian nations could be as high as 1,000 people. Hundreds have died in Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam, the Philippines, and Sri Lanka. This follows tropical storms that have recently hit the region. Thousands of people have been displaced. Children who get their own smartphones early in adolescence have an increased risk of depression, obesity, and losing sleep. That's according to a new study published in the journal Pediatrics. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
About half of all children in the U.S. have their own smartphone by age 11. To find out how this might affect health outcomes in early adolescence, researchers looked at data from more than 10,000 youth in more than 21 states who'd been tracked since late childhood. They found that tweens who had their own smartphone at age 12 were more likely to have obesity, symptoms of depression, and report insufficient sleep compared to their peers without phones. And the younger they got their phones, the higher their risk for some of these conditions. The researchers say they hope their findings will help inform the creation of guidelines on the appropriate age at which kids should first get their own smartphones. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to KAXE.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Washington, D.C. It's open enrollment time for people who have to buy health insurance on their own through healthcare.gov. And that's about 24 million Americans. Coming up, we'll speak with Democratic Senator Ron Wyden about the debate in Congress over extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies set to expire at the end of the year.
First, let's get an overview over where things stand on what's also known as Obamacare with Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent with our reporting partner, KFF Health News. So, Julie, people can shop for their health insurance, but the price they're seeing may not be final. Why is that?
That's right. You know, there have always been tax credits to help people afford their coverage on the Affordable Care Act health exchanges. In 2021, Congress made those tax credits much larger because they were concerned during the pandemic that more people should have health insurance. And it really worked. It doubled enrollment in the Affordable Care Act. Well, those extra subsidies are set to expire at the end of December. Congress is still fighting over whether to extend them. So people who are getting on the internet now and looking at the prices are seeing the extra subsidized prices, which in many cases are much, much larger. But we still don't know if Congress is going to extend those additional subsidies, which would bring those prices down.
So you said Congress is still fighting over this. How likely politically, though, is it that Congress will actually act?
Well, we will see in the fairly near future. The Senate has promised to vote to Democrats in order to get them to reopen the government. That's set for no later than the end of next week. Republicans, though, are still scrambling to have something to offer as an alternative.
Now, when it comes to that alternative, what is it? Do they have a plan?
A lot of Republicans have plans, but they're not all on the same page. In fact, we saw early last week, President Trump floated a plan that would have extended the subsidies temporarily, and that met with a big backlash, and he backed off. And you've got, you know, some Republicans saying we shouldn't be giving any kind of tax credits or subsidies to insurance companies. We should give the money directly to individuals. Economists say that's not going to help most people pay their health bills, even if they have kind of a minor health ailment. So Republicans, as they have been for the last 20-some years, are divided over how to proceed.
So what are the takeaways then for people who need to buy health insurance in these ACA marketplaces?
Well, we're looking at a pretty hard deadline. If you want to have insurance starting January 1st, you have to select a plan by December 15th, which is obviously just 2 weeks away. You know, there are many ways to sort of calculate what your premiums would be without these additional tax credits and what they would be if, for some reason, Congress actually manages to extend them. But right now, it's pretty hard for the average consumer to figure out what to do, because it's pretty hard for us political reporters to figure out what we should be doing.
2 weeks away, though. I mean, that's not a lot of time. I mean, what are the odds Congress even acts before then?
It seems unlikely Congress will act before then. However, if Congress does eventually act and extends the tax credits, then there will be an opportunity for people who have selected plans to go in and sort of select a new plan. Maybe they're going to shop, you know, they'll select a cheaper plan for next year because that's all they can afford. And if the tax credits get extended, they might be able to afford something more akin to what they have now. And they will be able to go back and change it. In most states, open enrollment doesn't end until January 15th. And obviously, if Congress makes some changes, they could also extend that open enrollment again. So people shouldn't panic as much as they may be panicking now.
That's Julie Robner, Chief Washington Correspondent with our partner KFF Health News. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For more on the politics surrounding health care costs and extending Affordable Care Act subsidies, Senator Ron Wyden is on the line. The senior senator from Oregon is the highest ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee. Good morning, Senator.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I want to start with what we just heard from Julie Robner there. You know, December 15th is when a lot of people have to sign up for their coverage to start January 1st. That gives Congress 2 weeks to get something done to address insurance costs. Is that possible?
Well, a clean extension of the tax credits is the only timely step that's going to prevent millions of Americans from experiencing a big premium increase. And that's going to happen very quickly. And the problem is that the Republicans want to tack on harmful policies that mostly help big insurance. So we Democrats are trying to work with the Republicans and both sides. But we've been talking to them for a long time.
What specific policies are you concerned about?
Big insurance policies that are junk insurance, for example, basically savings accounts, for example, that give a few benefits but nothing that's going to help with cancer. It's mostly stuff that helps big insurance.
Last week, House Republican leaders pushed back against a reported White House plan that would have extended the Affordable Care Act subsidies for 2 years. What did you make of that backlash?
Well, clearly they're fighting, but the problem is Trump has always had concepts, but never a real bill. And this legislation, as far as we can tell, is going to be mostly higher deductibles, more co-payments, junk insurance, not going to do something for working families. That's our bottom line.
What are the biggest sticking points when it comes to finding a compromise on this issue to get an extension some type of movement?
Yeah, it seems in the last couple of days, Trump is actually rejecting some effort at tax credits. And I think that's the only timely thing that's going to keep people from getting clobbered in the short term. We're going to say we'll work with them. For example, I've written a policy that's very aggressive in terms of fighting fraud. They say they care about it. So if they want to be bipartisan, we'll work with them.
Are there signs that there is traction for what you want among your Republican colleagues?
Well, everybody's coming back today. My sense is a lot of families were around the Thanksgiving table wondering how they were going to deal with these huge increases. They'll be talking to their senators, and I think they're going to say, get something done. We had a hearing before we left, and what people just said is, get it done, lower these premiums.
I think everyone, though, agrees that this is a short-term solution to a long-term problem, which is healthcare is unaffordable for a lot of Americans, and especially without these subsidies. Is there a solution to address the root cause of high health care so this doesn't become a political debate every few years where Americans are wondering whether their premiums are going to go up?
Once we've dealt with this issue, we're ready to go on the long term. In particular, I'm going to be focused on these out-of-control administrative costs. Looks like they're racking up close to $1 trillion a year. It's insanely complicated. That'll be a priority for me.
What, beyond that, when you look at reforms, what reforms should the Affordable Care Act be undergoing?
Well, certainly we can look at a variety of approaches, and I'm going to talk about fighting fraud. I've introduced a proposal that would allow us to deal with these out-of-control insurance brokers. We ought to have tough criminal penalties on them, and then we ought to go after these big insurance proposals.
As part of the deal to end the government shutdown, Senate Republicans promised Democrats to hold a vote on a Democratic health care bill by mid-December. Do you expect that vote to be successful?
My proposal is, let's get to work. We're going to talk to the Republicans. Right now, there's no deal, but if there isn't a bill, there's going to be an awful human crisis. Millions are going to lose coverage. I've got folks at home in Eugene, Oregon, you know, who are looking at a 500% increase in premiums. We're going to have folks devastated. And by the way, Julie Rovner knows this. It's going to jack up employer-sponsored health care costs as well, to the biggest increase we've seen in small businesses in years.
Looking ahead at next year's midterm, is health care the main issue that your constituents are concerned about?
Well, the combination of the huge Medicaid cuts and what's going to be done to rural hospitals, this makes this a front and center issue. I've always said health care is the most important issue, because if you and your loved ones don't have your health, everything else goes by the board. There are going to be a lot of people who can't pay for health care with this.
And what is your message to both your Democratic colleagues and Republican colleagues right now as you think about health care costs?
My message is, we want to support legislation that lowers health costs and prevents Americans from losing their health insurance. We will work with anybody, Republicans, that will meet that standard.
That's Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Luigi Mangione is back in court today. He's a 27-year-old accused of killing United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson on a Manhattan street nearly a year ago. As Walter Wathman of member station WNYC reports, Mangione's defense attorneys are trying to get certain evidence thrown out ahead of trial.
About this time last year, police arrested Mangione in the back of a Pennsylvania McDonald's after a days-long nationwide manhunt. Investigators say they found evidence in Mangione's backpack linking him to Thompson's shooting. A handgun, a silencer, and a notebook where he allegedly wrote of his intent to, quote, whack an insurance executive. Mangione's defense attorneys say police did not read him his Miranda rights for 20 minutes. New York Law School professor Anna Kaminsky says that could be a problem for the government's case.
The defense is arguing that the defendant was in custody and being interrogated, and therefore should have been Mirandized. And because he wasn't, any statements that were obtained were in violation of his constitutional rights and therefore should be suppressed.
Defense attorneys also argue police didn't have a proper warrant when they searched Mangione's backpack. But former federal prosecutor Jason Swergold says police have wide latitude to make searches during an arrest.
I think that, you know, the defense is going to have an uphill battle when it comes to suppressing evidence found in the backpack.
Crowds of people are expected to attend Mangione's hearings this week, as he's become something of a folk hero. There are thousands of internet memes glorifying Mangione as a vigilante. Prosecutors push back on this characterization and argue Mangione murdered a father of two in cold blood. Mangione has pleaded not guilty to state and federal murder charges. The federal charges carry the possibility of the death penalty. The judge in Mangione's New York case could set a trial date this week. For NPR News, I'm Walter Wathman in New York City.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:19. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:30, Minnesota Native News, and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Coming up just after 7, a special edition of the Up North Report. And at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Sarah Bignall and I will take a closer look at many of the events happening throughout the week. You can find a list of those and more at KAXC.org. Look for Events Up North. Partly sunny today, highs in the low to mid-teens, winds from the west up to 15 miles per hour. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the right time to give to KAXC and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps People Powered Radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXC. We thank you so much. The Iron Range Area Council of Minnesota Chippewa Tribes has their annual Christmas party on Thursday, December 4th, 6 o'clock at Marble City Hall. Enjoy a potluck dinner and native bingo. And the Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st, 2026. Funds will be earmarked for the library's 2027 budget. Thanks for tuning in to KAXC this morning. There's more ahead from Morning Edition.
NPR comes from this station and from the Union of Concerned Scientists, championing science in the fight for a healthy, safe, and just future. Learn more at ucs.org. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Steve Hartman is a CBS News correspondent known for his upbeat, life-affirming stories. But how do you do that job when your bosses send you to cover communities affected by school shootings?
They used to call on me to do something, this is going to sound crazy, but kind of uplifting. Restore people's faith in humanity, I guess. Maybe find the hero teacher or the community coming together, something like that. And I kind of got tired of it.
So Steve Hartman started his own project. He waited until long after the shootings. Then he asked the families of children killed by gunfire to allow a photographer to take pictures of their kids' undisturbed bedrooms.
It was a huge ask because these bedrooms, they're sacred spaces.
Those photographs are the basis for a new documentary on Netflix called All the Empty Rooms.
Thanks for taking my call. What I'd like to do is come with Lou Bope, photographer, and just let Lou take pictures of the room as it was and try to capture Hallie through those pictures.
Feel like we would like to share her.
Yeah.
I think we're also nervous.
Yeah, I'm nervous too.
I got many replies. Some said we're not ready or, you know, it's too personal, but a handful agreed and wanted us to come. But so often I have learned after some time has passed and the rest of the world has moved on to other stories, the parents want their child remembered. And we were offering a chance to remind the country of who these kids were. And parents were willing.
When it comes to the bedrooms, why do they decide to keep these bedrooms preserved?
I sometimes feel like closing up the bedrooms and repurposing the rooms is almost like another stage of grief that a lot of parents just aren't ready to tackle. The rooms are a source of comfort, but they're also a bit of an albatross because some parents feel like they'd like to maybe move to a different city, but they can't because they just can't pack up that room.
One mother says that she goes into her child's room every day.
Many of them go in every single day. Some sit in a chair beside the bed and talk to their child.
A few of the families mentioned smell. They wanted to keep the smell of their kids around. I had to smile at one of them when she said that she did laundry because kids smell, right? They smell sometimes in bad ways.
We washed his chonies and his socks because I thought that was gross. His underwear and his socks I pulled out and washed, but everything else is how it was almost 5 years ago, his dirty clothes. I don't think we wanted to lose his smell in his room because it's distinctly him.
That was a parent from the Saugus High School shooting in California. I think sometimes even a bad smell becomes a good smell when it's all you have.
What kind of things was your photographer focusing on? How did he approach his side of this assignment?
Every time he went into a room, there was certain reverence there. Would not open a drawer, would not move anything. And he was looking for things that kind of define that child. It might be a memento from a trip, library book that never got returned. But he also found little details, like one of the pictures that struck me most was a toothpaste tube with the cap open. I can so imagine that kid brushing their teeth that morning, fully expecting that they would come back and maybe close that lid, you know, that night. And there's just so many signs of the life cut short and how quickly it was extinguished.
When I was watching your documentary, Steve, I saw you in Uvalde. I went to Uvalde the night that the shooting happened to cover it. I've never felt suffocated out in fresh air like I felt in Uvalde. It was a feeling that I'll never forget, and I hope I never, ever have to feel that ever again.
She's in her room.
Love the lights.
She loved the lights.
Yeah.
And they've actually been on since she left them on. We haven't turned them off.
That family, the Cazares family, I remember standing near them during a vigil. When you spoke to them, the Cazares family, what did they tell you in terms of how the rest of Uvalde is coping with this now 3 years later?
Well, that was such a small community and such a traumatic major event that I don't think they're too much better now than they were when you were there. That said, you go into a family and meet the Cazareses, and there is room for laughter now.
And the stuffed animals, I think it's just these two that have her voice in it, right?
Yeah. That's the video where she was outside with the dog.
There's been some softening there, but it's going to be a long, long while before that community has fully healed, if ever.
The last thing you say in this documentary is, I wish that we could transport all Americans to stand in one of those bedrooms for just a few minutes. We'd be a different America. Steve, you mentioned how you were the find the positive angle guy for a long time. To me, this statement does still ring true to who you are, because it is a very optimistic statement.
Thanks for saying that, because I do feel like the film is optimistic. But it is going to take people to be a little vulnerable and to watch the film, because I do believe that. I do believe that if we stand in their rooms, if we look around, that maybe we can make a difference. And that is kind of a new feeling for me. When I started this project, I did not have a great deal of hope. But with the momentum that the film has now, I feel like maybe there is a chance if we just get folks to stand in the rooms.
That's CBS News correspondent Steve Hartman. His new documentary is called All the Empty Rooms. It is streaming on Netflix. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Jamaica's recovery plan following Hurricane Melissa will cost an estimated $8 billion. Now officials need to decide whether to rebuild with wood or switch to concrete.
The technology exists. The implementation is what is key, and just taking the right decision and right choices.
I'm Scott Detrow, rebuilding Jamaica for resilience on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is coming up on 6:30. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday morning show. Coming up, we'll have National Native News and then Laura Erickson speaking for the birds today, talking about getting older and birding. Taking a look at our current temperatures, it is pretty chilly. 2 degrees in Aiken, 3 degrees in Brainerd and Grand Rapids, 8 in Hibbing looks to be our warm spot. It is 6 in Bemidji, 4 in Park Rapids. A mix of clouds and sun today with highs near 16, winds from the southwest 5 to 10, gusting higher. Cloudy tonight, lows near 4, and for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 19 to 22, southwest winds gusting up to 15 miles per hour. Chance of snow overnight with lows in the single digits, and then Wednesday mostly sunny with highs in the low teens. You can answer our question of the week. This week we want to hear about the things that you make or maybe have made in the past to give as gifts. You can text in 218-326-1234. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Right now, it is time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A month after the devastating Western Alaska storm, hundreds of evacuees are still sheltering in hotels in Anchorage. This week, some received a delivery of subsistence food donations, a small taste of home, during the holiday season. Ayolna Nyden with the Alaska Desk has this story.
Stephanie Anover answers the door to her hotel room. A volunteer hands her a bag filled with traditional foods.
Oh, it's fish, salmon, and some strips.
Anover was living in Kipnik when the remnants of Typhoon Halon destroyed her home. She's one of more than 600 displaced people staying in Anchorage hotels. The storm also devastated traditional harvests.
Left us with nothing.
Anover says she's thankful to receive the subsistence food donations.
It's good to have native food subsistence to share with my family. Yes, yes.
Alaska Native Heritage Center and other local organizations have been gathering subsistence food donations for over a month, and they have been distributing them to evacuees. Veronica Berger is a program manager at the Heritage Center. She says they have delivered to about 250 rooms in hotels across Anchorage.
They lost a lot of their harvests, their gatherings, so it's helped get a little taste of home.
Berger says the Heritage Center staff try to be mindful of the conditions people have in hotels and deliver food that they can actually use. She says they have two types of donation bags. The one for hotels with kitchens includes items like fish fillets and moose meat cuts. And evacuees who don't have kitchens receive a bag with items they don't have to cook, like muktuk and herring eggs.
Anything that they can eat raw, I guess.
For Elizabeth Smith from Kipnik, the most exciting item in the food bag was
herring eggs, but I need oil.
Smith says she usually adds seal oil to herring eggs, so she wishes the donation bag included that. For now, she says she will keep the food donations in her mini fridge.
My family is over at the Aspen. I might go see them. I might share them this.
In addition to delivering food to hotels, the Heritage Center also hosted potlucks and is planning more events in the months to come. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
A new report highlights the high levels of childhood trauma among juveniles who are tried as adults. Juvenile justice advocates are seeking reforms that consider these experiences before, during, and after interactions with the court system. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The research from Human Rights for Kids show of the more than 2,200 incarcerated people surveyed, greater than 80% experienced four or more adverse childhood experiences, a rate far higher than the general population. In a recent webinar, report co-author Aiden Leslie explained many respondents endured severe abuse beginning around age six, had been trafficked or exploited, or had committed offenses linked directly to their abuse. He says almost none had their trauma taken taken into account by judges during their sentencing.
Once children end up in the adult justice system, they face a level of repression and victimization that only serves to compound the trauma they've already experienced, while failing to actually address that trauma. The justice system itself also tends to serve as an extremely intimidating and traumatic experience.
Leslie says some of the profound developmental impacts of trauma include higher rates of mental health conditions among youth in the system, with especially severe experiences for girls and Native American children. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You can hear the latest version of National Native News today at 4:30 during All Things Considered. National Native News produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Chilly morning so far with temperatures in the single digits. Our forecast for today, a mix of clouds and sun, highs near 16, winds from the southwest 5 to 10, gusting higher. Cloudy tonight, lows near 4, and for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 19 to 22, southwest winds up to 15 miles per hour. There's a chance of some light snow overnight tomorrow, lows in the single digits, and then Wednesday, mostly sunny with highs in the low teens. Support for KAXE comes from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota, carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist on the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us. It's time now to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
Back in 1980, when I was teaching junior high math, my students were learning about prime numbers right when my 29th birthday came around. So, of course, I told them that I was now officially in my prime. I've used that lame joke a lot over the years, most recently in 2022 when I turned 71. Now, next month when I turn 73, well, I'll be back in my prime once again. The concept of prime numbers will elude my grandson Walter for a few years more, but he's very interested in people's ages, and he knows that every day everybody gets one day older. Before his August birthday, he told his parents that he did not want to turn 4. 3.5 is the best age because you can't get old and die when you're 3.5. He told me that when he grows up, he wants to be a veterinarian, a doctor, a construction worker, and a grocery store clerk. He said on the days that he's a doctor, he wants to figure out how to make old people's ears work better so I can hear every kind of bird again. He said that won't happen till he's a grown-up, when I will be very, very, very old, but that's okay because I must still be alive. I've never been proactive about getting old, at least not like Russ's parents. When Russ and I were still dating while his parents were in their 50s and his dad was still working, they were already members of ARP. My father-in-law retired when he was 62. When I was 62, I was just getting started with the most active decade of my life, with nary a moment's thought about slowing down, much less retiring. I'd never made it to a foreign country except Canada until I was in my 50s, and I did the vast majority of my long-distance travel in my 60s, to Cuba, Costa Rica, Panama, Peru, Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Uganda. And I was in my 60s when I did my big year, camping alone in remote areas here and there as I crisscrossed the lower 48, seeing 604 species in the wild, 595 of them ABA countable. I turned 68 in 2019, one of the most busy, exciting, and rewarding years of my entire career, with speaking gigs in Rhode Island, Indiana, Maine, Arizona, and Massachusetts. Russ and I went birding in the Florida Everglades and Keys, visited Chicago for our 50th high school reunion, and went to California to see the Peace, Love, and Woodstock exhibit at the Charles M. Schulz Museum in Santa Rosa, which was displaying my own 1994 1996 letter to Charles Schulz and his response to me. On that trip, Russ got his first up-close and personal views of a California condor, and we took one of Debbie Shearwater's wonderful pelagic trips. If that wasn't enough travel for a single year, 2019 was also the year I went with my dear friend Susan Eaton on a birding trip to Panama, which was even more splendid than I'd anticipated, and I tend to anticipate a lot of impossibly wonderful things. Yep, 2019, the year I turned 68, was a darned good year. I closed it out with cataract surgery, but that made my long-distance vision clearer and brighter than it ever was when I was young. I'd already had my first heart attack and first bout with breast cancer, but so far, so good. 5 years later, it's sobering to remember that my father, brother, sister, grandmother, and godfather never made it to 68, and a sweet little Walter reminds me, I'm old. Does birding keep us young? Not literally, of course. My birth certificate still says I was born on November 11th, 1951. Since that wonderful 2019, I've had a second heart attack and bout with breast cancer, a scary episode with vertigo, and two bouts of COVID. But just as in all the previous decades, the two things in my life that have kept me happy and engaged through the pandemic and aftermath have been my family and birding. I may be getting older, but as Walter reminds me, so is every four-year-old. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. It is 6:41. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. You can listen to our new Season Watch podcast with host Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out on Thursdays. It also airs over the weekend here on KAXE, 1:30 in the afternoon on Saturday, 10:30 in the morning on Sunday. KAXE News is working on a story explaining the complex workings behind your property taxes, but we need your help. You can share your property tax statement with us and your questions. Email news@kaxe.org. These real-world examples will help everyone better understand how and why you may be seeing your taxes rise. Of course, we will not share any personal information. The news team will contact you, and of course, yes, your information will remain confidential. Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series today at noon with Minnesota author Will Weaver. He'll talk about his new book, Black Dirt, Bright Stars. It's a sequel to his Power and Light book that came out a few years following the saga of the Haugen family. Coming up about 1 hour from now, it's What We're Reading, our show all about books, produced by our staff librarian Tammy Bobrowski. Today we'll be hearing book recommendations from Tracy Campa, the children's librarian at the Grand Rapids Area Library. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Andrew DeZingle, your host for Headwaters. And Andrew's request line theme is songs from artists that once were with a band and now maybe better known for solo artists. Yes, artists known for bands who then went solo. So you can text in your suggestions on that, 218-326-1234. Also answer our question of the week. We want to hear about those things that you make for Christmas gifts or maybe that you have made in the past. If you're a crafty or handy-dandy person, you can text us, 218-326-1234. Love to see photos of those as well. And we'll be talking more about that throughout the week. My Neighbor to Love Coalition in Brainerd is working to end homelessness for 30 neighbors this December. Construction is nearly complete on 19 units at Creekside Community. but funds are needed to purchase basic household furnishings. Learn more at mntlc.org/donate. You can also listen to the interview we did on The Bright Spot a few weeks ago with Vicki Kinney from My Neighbor to Love Coalition. That is at kaxc.org. The Clearwater County Historical Society hosts the Festival of Trees beginning tomorrow. You can enjoy more than 30 trees. Vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. We continue now with Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Martinez. A new survey of centenarians finds that people who make it to 100 are more socially engaged and physically active compared to results a decade ago asking people who were at least 100 back then. Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey.
If you ask a centenarian how old they feel, they're likely to say they feel decades younger at heart. This includes Robert Earl Jackson, who turned 100 this year.
Feel good, just feel good. Time just go by so fast.
There are about 100,000 centenarians in the U.S. right now, and that's expected to quadruple by mid-century. Jackson, who lives in Prince George's County, Maryland, says one key to a long life is to reframe your expectations.
I thank God for waking up a new day.
It's what centenarians are doing each day that's inspiring, says Dr. Rhonda Randall. She's the chief medical officer at United Healthcare, the group behind the new survey. They surveyed centenarians back in 2015 and again this year.
A decade ago, 34% said that they were doing strength training. Now it's 46% of people over the age of 100 are saying they're doing some type of strength training on a weekly basis.
36% say they participate in some kind of stress relief activity, like meditation or prayer. Many say they focus on a healthy diet. The survey also found 40% play video games regularly, and almost 1 in 3 have tried ChatGPT or another AI platform, showing curiosity about new technology.
I think one of the things that we can learn from these folks is that it's a holistic view of your health, right? It's not just one thing.
Randall says the importance of family and social connections really stands out. Nearly 80% of the centenarians say they get together with family and friends at least once a week.
If you look at the communities that have the greatest levels of social connection, you'll see lower rates of diseases, lower rates of chronic conditions, longer life expectancies. So I think all of that is important.
Dr. Jonathan Rosand is the co-founder of the McCants Center for Brain Health at Mass General Brigham. He says the survey is just a small sample of 100 centenarians, but it points to a growing focus and ability to keep up with the times.
They're putting a lot of cognitive energy into taking care of themselves in ways that are totally in the mainstream.
Successful aging is the result of lots of factors, including genes, access to good health care, income, and luck plays a role too. Dr. Rosand says a big part of moving the needle towards a longer, healthier life does come down to daily choices.
What we've learned is that the core of successful aging is in the lifestyle choices we make every day. There isn't a magic pill.
What his research shows is the earlier in life that people adopt healthy habits, the more likely they are to fend off the common diseases of aging and thrive later in life. He says it's not just about living longer, it's about living better that matters most. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, how one organization is trying to use AI to reshape American politics and get more independents elected to Congress. Listen in the NPR app or on this dependable, reliable public radio station. This is NPR News.
It is 6:49. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXC. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, we'll have more from Morning Edition. We'll hear about Advent in immigrant congregations, also about AI and holiday deals. And after 7 o'clock, we'll have the Up North Report. And coming up at 7:20, it's Events Up North. Sarah Bignall and I will take a look at what's going on throughout the region this week. You can also find a comprehensive list at kaxc.org. Look for Events Up North. And as always, if you have events to share with us, send those via email. That's the best way. PSA at kaxc.org. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. There is more ahead from Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXC.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldil. The Advent season has begun. Christians use these weeks leading up to Christmas as a time of preparation. But as NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports from Los Angeles, for some congregations with large immigrant populations, this Advent is also a time of apprehension.
On a recent Sunday in West L.A., a pastor greets her flock.
A joyous welcome as we gather in the house of the Lord on this, the Lord's Day.
This congregation is about 20% immigrants, some with legal status, others without.
Praise to you, O God of mercy.
Sitting in a back pew, singing along, is Mike. He asked that we use the anglicized version of his Farsi name because he fears speaking out could complicate his immigration status. Mike is seeking asylum on religious grounds. He fled Iran after converting to Christianity.
I keep this secret, my faith as a secret, for like 12 years.
Mike came to Los Angeles 18 months ago, where he feels freer to worship. Currently, he's awaiting an asylum hearing that keeps getting delayed.
Since I came to this country, I'm trying to be a good person for the community, respect to the rules, respect to the culture of this country.
Since this summer, when immigration crackdowns began here, he's felt less free. In June, federal agents arrested two people outside another congregation with a large Iranian population, not far from this one.
Even church is not safe because it's a public place. They can get there and catch you.
The Department of Homeland Security tells NPR that enforcement actions at churches need secondary approval and are expected to be rare. We're not naming Mike's congregation because church leadership fears drawing attention from immigration authorities. Enough Iranian immigrants worship here that often the pastor invites them to lead the Lord's Prayer in Farsi. But the pastor says fewer are taking her up on that offer to lead the prayers in what she calls the language of their hearts.
So it's part of the heartbreak of these days where they feel like they have to be apprehensive about it, not even wanting to speak in their own language here.
These fears, she says, are especially poignant this time of year when people want to gather.
Advent leading up to that is to use that time to prepare us to really give thanks for this God we have who wants to be with us.
east of Los Angeles, at Baldwin Park United Methodist Church, Pastor Tonio Rios is unzipping a red tent pitched in the sanctuary itself.
The tent is waiting for the people who need it.
For years, this congregation received newly arrived immigrants in the U.S. and gave them a place to sleep while finding jobs and apartments. Rios keeps this tent here to remind her congregation, 80% of whom are immigrants and are living in fear, that they too once needed a place to lay their heads.
A lot of them say, don't open the door, just close the door.
But Rios wants her church to be a place that says, there is room for you at the inn.
It is very hard, but Jesus is going to be born in our heart. That's why we need to be prepared. And how we prepare every day, we need to be prepared to receive Jesus.
Preparing for that joy seems especially difficult for Rorahi Lopez, who's worshipped here for more than two decades. She's a U.S. citizen, but has a lot of family who aren't. And because she's Latina, she says she feels targeted anyway.
What if on my way to church, they catch us? I mean, it's the fear, like on a daily basis. I mean, we're scared of going to the school, to work, to church, to even the grocery store.
Lopez sees immigration and customs enforcement vans in her neighborhood and on the way to church. She says this time of year, it makes her think of the Christmas story.
Mary and Joseph didn't have a place to stay. They were looking for a place to stay. And even though so many doors were closed, somebody opened a door.
This theme of hopeful welcome is what Pastor Tonio Rios had in mind when picking the hymn her congregation is singing every Sunday throughout Advent.
Toda la tierra espera al Salvador.
All earth is hopeful, she sings. The Savior comes at last. Furrows lie open for God's creative task. This, the labor of people who struggle to see how God's truth and justice set everybody free. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Artificial intelligence is changing holiday shopping. According to a survey from Adobe Analytics, just over a third of shoppers in the U.S. have used artificial intelligence to help with online shopping. Adobe projects that traffic from AI sources to retail sites this holiday season will increase over 500% from last year.
Mike Tedasco has been thinking about this. He's a visiting fellow at San Diego State University's AI Center. And on this Cyber Monday, he has tips on using AI tools to find gifts without breaking the bank. Popular chatbots such as Google's Gemini, OpenAI's ChatGPT, and Anthropic's Claude can show a product's price history and make predictions about price changes.
And I would simply ask it. And say, hey, this is currently at this price. What were the prices before? Does this often go down in price in December? So maybe it's worthwhile to wait. Check out other websites. And the AI tools can do that.
Tedesco says AI can also help pick out furniture or an appliance like a TV that will fit into your living room and into your budget.
You can say, hey, the couch is about 10 feet away from where the TV is going to be. How big of a screen size should I get? You can put all of this into a prompt and say, give me the recommendations of the top five TVs that will be the best price.
Tedasco says chatbots can also set up what's called an AI agent to keep an eye on changing prices.
You can actually have the agent scouring the website once a day, twice a day, whatever it is. And if it hits a certain price threshold, it could email you.
Now, AI models aren't perfect. And Tedasco also reminds us that there are just some things AI cannot replace.
The most meaningful gifts that I have ever gotten have come from my children. And it's just something that they made by, you know, their own sweat on a piece of construction paper. And those are the things we love and cherish.
AI, I can't do that. A, one thing I cherish is getting to host this show with you.
Wait, is this AI Layla? Human Layla wouldn't say that to me. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin, the real one.
It is just before 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. Lots of local news stories and conversations for you to check out there. And click the donate button to become a member. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have coming up next the Up North Report, local news from our region. And at 7:20, it's events up.